It's Physical Therapy Day on the Lee Rayburn Show, and I am lucky enough to have returning with us today our physical therapy experts who are here to answer any of your questions about aches, pains, injuries, and what you can do to get moving and help improve your quality of life. You can join our conversation at any time this hour by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can always send us an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest, Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist and partner at Start Strong Physical Therapy online at startstrongpt.com. She's there alongside her sister, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Lori's also a professor at Rocky Mountain University of Health Professions. And Lori, welcome back.
Hey, Lee. It's great to see you this morning. It's great to see some rain. Hello.
Maybe clear the air a little bit and get outside and get moving. Wouldn't that be nice? Jill Tyne Nissenbaum's also with Start Strong Physical Therapy at startstrongpt.com and is a professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. And Jill, welcome back to you.
It's great to be here today. Looking forward to great conversations.
And as we are setting up your calls and questions, I want to begin with a statistic that could be staggering for some, and that is 1/3 of people over 65 will fall every year. That, according to the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, and falling can be a leading cause of death in Wisconsin for those who are 65 years old or older. Why are we falling so much, and what are the causes of this? Falling isn't a disease, it's a symptom. Lori?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, Lee, 1/3 of people over 65, I'm in that category. I'm one of those people who fell. And it was one of those things where it was what we would call unfavorable flooring. I caught my foot. I had on new shoes with a thicker sole than I was used to. And I caught my foot when I was turning. So I really love that you mentioned quality of life, because when you fall, it's not just your high risk of fracture, which in the elderly is a really important issue. So 10% of falls result in a fracture. 75% of all spine-related fractures happen in people who are 75 years old or older. And after a hip fracture, an elderly person has a 27% chance of dying within 1 year.
Ooh.
So hip fractures are not a benign thing in the elderly. So it's really important for people to remain safe. There are a number of things that predispose people to falling across the age spectrum, but particularly from elderly people, like poor lighting in your home. You know, how often do people get up to use the restroom during the night? Maybe you've got a nightlight, but still the light is dim. You get up and maybe you're a little bit achy or stiff because you've been sleeping. So all these things contribute. Maybe during the day you use an assistive device. Maybe you have a cane or walking poles, but at night you don't grab those. We also have things like rugs, steps, a little bubble in the carpet that you forgot about. All those things can predispose people to trips. Other things are situational, like walking and talking at the same time, because you're distracted. You're not looking around. And I know from walking around my neighborhood and walking my dog, there's little uneven areas in the sidewalks, and it's really easy to catch your foot. So all those things can lead to these falls and fractures, and they can significantly impact your quality of life.
Joe, go ahead.
So it's interesting. Lori brought up walking and talking, because one of the tests that you can use to assess your falls risk is called the DGI, or the Dynamic Gait Index. And a couple of the variables in those have you walking a straight line, but lifting your head, moving your head up and down, And then also rotating your head side to side while you're walking. So it kind of gets to those points that Lori was talking about, that you can't always necessarily look straight ahead, or you may be distracted while you're walking, and that could be a factor. So the DGI looks at that. We're going to talk a little bit about a different test. It's called the TUG test, or the timed up and go test. And there was a really interesting article that looked at 1.6 million people did the TUG test. And before we get into many details, I'll tell you what that test is. It's called the timed up and go. You need a chair with arms. You need to mark out 3 meters, which is about 10 feet. And you need a stopwatch. And you have the person, as soon as they arise from the chair, the time starts. You have to get up from the chair, walk those 3 meters, turn around. And Lori said she fell when she turned. So that's a key component. Walk back and sit back down. So that is the TUG test. So it's not fancy. It doesn't require a lot of equipment. They did this on 1.6 million people. And again, it's measured by time. And what they found is those people with a poorer TUG performance, in other words, their time was higher, was associated with an increased risk of overall fractures, particularly hip fractures, as Lori talked about the importance of that. So we have this pretty easy test that you can apply to someone to see kind of what their risk is. And as a general rule, for people 65 and over, you should be able to do that test. Stand up, walk 3 meters, walk back, sit down in under 10 seconds. If you're between 12 seconds and 30 seconds, you're at a high risk of falling. And anyone over 30 seconds indicates severe mobility and functional independence issues. So the times are actually kind of broken down to kind of indicate somebody's risk with this timed up and go test.
So it's from a chair that has arms on it,
yep.
And you get up from that, you walk about 10 feet, you turn around and you come back, and your goal is to get it within 10 seconds.
Correct. It starts when you arise from the chair, and it stops when your buttocks hit the chair when you're completing the test. And if you need to use an assistive device, you can use your assistive device with this as well. So, you start with your arms on the chair, and if you use a walker or a cane, you stand up and you grab your assistive device and you do those 3 meters out and back per se, those 10 feet.
Trish emailed us, when she turned 50 many years ago, she decided that she only needed to remember the first 7 letters of the alphabet. Always be careful. Don't ever forget gravity.
Very nice.
That's
mnemonic.
A great one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And I think the other thing that people need to remember, and this is similar to what Chris says, is to take your time. Always remember. So I think today we're so often in a hurry, or we're so focused on other things. And, now we have phones to help distract us and keep us from focusing on what we're doing. And sometimes I tell patients, before you do something, stop for just a second and think to make sure that you're aligned, that your feet are where you think they are. When you take a step, you know where you're stepping, all those things. And all it takes is just a little beat to stop and make sure you're safe before you start moving.
Well, you mentioned rugs, Lori, and I think about throw rugs or just area rugs and how they can slip underneath you regardless of the age and how dangerous they can be if you have any sort of balance issues whatsoever. Jill?
I think any change in the floor surface, whether it's going, change in carpet plushness, change a little lip, things like that, those can become very challenging for people, especially if they have a tendency to kind of shuffle their feet a little bit more as we age, it becomes very problematic. Extension cords, small dogs, small animals that don't get out of your way.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And I know that Oakwood Village has a SAIL program, or a Safe at Home program, and they will come to your home and do a safety assessment. So they have a standardized packet of materials. They have volunteers who go out and will do an assessment of your home.
But that's the external factors. There can be some internal factors as well, as I understand it. And before we get to those, let's take a call from Matt in Amro today at 1-800-642-1234. Hi, Matt.
Hi, I'm glad you took my call. Got a question. Just a week ago, I dislocated a left shoulder. And I saw a doctor on a follow-up 7 days later. And I just have a question as to what she informed me on. A little back history. I'm 67. I'm very good shape. I had rotator cuff issues. I had the right shoulder repaired some years ago. And the left shoulder, I kind of let go with wanting to get it repaired, but just never did. Now, going in with the dislocation, I mentioned to the doctor, well, you know, the rotator cuff was bad. It probably didn't help with how it dislocated easily when I fell. But she said, I said, well, now they could go in and do the rotator cuff repair and see if there's any other damage. And her consensus was, well, you're 67. You probably, we don't do that when you get of age or whatever. And I was kind of taken aback because I'd like to have this arm working as good as possible. So any insights as to I'm too old, I'm healthy, I probably look more like 57 than 67. So.
Yeah, thank you, Matt. And you probably feel that way, too, with the exception of this dislocated shoulder, Jill.
Yeah, so I'm really glad you said your age, because age matters when you dislocate your shoulder. Younger people will tear their labrum. So they'll have a different pathology. As we age and dislocate our shoulder, your rotator cuff becomes a higher risk for having pathology. Did you have an MRI, Matt?
Yes, they did an MRI. My left shoulder wasn't as bad as my right, but okay. Still they recommended repair. The tendon, whatever, the one that hangs down or whatever.
Supraspinatus, yeah.
That was ripped already. I know when they did my right shoulder, I think they said they snipped that or whatever for whatever reason, and you get kind of Popeye muscle.
That's a bicep. So are you having pain in your left shoulder? Were you having pain prior to this?
You know, it wasn't too bad. It would come and go. For a few months, it wouldn't be bad, but then all of a sudden it would bother me, like I have my arm out the window and I try to pull it back in. It's like, you know.
So what many people will recommend versus a rotator cuff repair, if you're not having, you know, unrelenting pain, is a surgery, but it's a debridement. It's kind of a cleanup of kind of the fraying tissue and things like that. And with cleaning up kind of some of the little floaties that are going around in there and some of the fraying of the muscle, with good physical therapy, many people are happy campers. So I think that would be the way I would go before I'd consider a rotator cuff repair immediately. And Lori has her hand up.
Yeah. And I just want to clarify, being the elder sister,
yes,
that it's not that they wouldn't do a repair because you're too old.
Right.
It has to do with what the status of your rotator cuff is over time and as you age. It's not that you're too old.
Correct.
Or something, but that at that age group, in that category, the rotator cuff is already degraded. So, and many people function very well without their rotator cuff. Most people, I can't remember what the percentages are. Maybe Jill, you remember, but people in their 70s and 80s, almost everybody has rotator cuff tears, and most people function just fine. And so if you're active and healthy, you can do very well without your rotator cuff. But you got to fix why you fell.
Yeah. why did you fall, Matt?
I was doing some repairs near a dock. I had my arm on a short fence. I slipped. The full weight of my body went down. My arm stayed up.
Yep. So in a situation like that, with an acute injury, you know, I think, as Jill said, going in and debriding things makes sense to clean it out. And then you're just going to rehab the daylights out of it. Make sure you get some good PT afterwards. Yeah.
Get it cleaned out and get it back moving again. Matt, thank you so much for the call. But this brings us back to falls again and some of the causes of falls. This one seems to have been situational for Matt. What are some of the internal reasons that people can take a fall, especially if they're 65 years or older? Lori?
Well, one of the big ones is medications.
Yes. Yeah.
So
So, you know, it's not uncommon for people to go in with condition A and their primary puts them on a medication. And then maybe they see a different provider for a different set of symptoms and they put them on yet another medication. And pretty soon you have an entire pharmacy in your medicine cabinet. So medications is probably a big one. Another intrinsic factor is vision. So, for example, our mother had low vision. She had macular degeneration, and she fell. Mm-hmm. So that can be a big factor. Again, if you get up during the night and maybe you don't put your glasses on or you're reaching for the bedside and you can't find your glasses, is an issue. And go ahead, Jill.
And then the other thing you think about is systemic diseases. So diabetes comes to mind, or mm-hmm. any time where you have a neuropathy or impaired sensation in your lower extremity and or weakness in your lower extremity. Those kind of things can also be factors where, you know, you can't feel the floor. You've lost that proprioceptive input. And a lot of people with diabetes have diabetic neuropathy into their mm-hmm. feet. So that's kind of a classic I think group that we think about.
What about loss of balance? Is that again more of a symptom than a disease? Is it caused by something else, but is also a factor in falling?
Yeah. So balance, at least we consider balance an impairment, like a loss of strength or loss of range of motion, loss of balance. And you can have a loss of balance for a number of reasons. It can be due to vestibular issues. It can be related to weakness. It can be related to some sort of systemic disease. Maybe you have a neurologic disease, a Parkinson's, or multiple sclerosis, or things like that. So there are a number of things that can cause impaired balance.
Hmm. Elaine in Madison emailed us. She is 75 years old. Last year, she fell and broke her hip. When she fell, she was in the kitchen standing next to a table as she reached down to pick something up from the floor, and she just fell without any warning. She has recovered from surgery and is almost back to her normal self. What worries her, though, is that she did not experience any dizziness or other symptoms before the fall. Should she be concerned that this could happen again? I'm certain I would be.
Yeah. So I guess one question would be to follow with her primary physician and make sure that there's no underlying issue that caused that fall, any systemic issue that might have been overlooked that caused that fall. And then if not, she should be seen for some balance training and maybe some vestibular training. Jill wants to say something.
Yeah, I always think about people who bend down and fall. If it's something to do with like temporary impaired blood flow to their head, lightheadedness that they don't even realize, things like that. Or if did they just move their center of mass so quickly because they took the upper half of their body down, you know, was that a factor? So she should have that looked at. And one of the things I do want to point out for people who are concerned or do have frequent falls, UW Health has a multidisciplinary falls clinic where multidisciplinary professionals are there. And as Lori mentioned, there's pharmacy there to look at all your medications. There's a geriatrician there. There's a physical therapist there. I believe they have an OT there that also works with getting you adaptive equipment so you don't have to put yourself in a situation where you're at risk of falls. So many larger hospital organizations do have a falls clinic that is multidisciplinary, one-stop shopping to kind of get all those factors that we've been talking about addressed.
And Elaine brings up a point that, you know, one of the other factors, intrinsic factors, is hypotension. So it may be that it happened so fast that she didn't realize that there was this sort of dizzy component. Sometimes it just happens so fast. It's not like you get dizzy and fall, but that abrupt change of position can result in some hypotension, and you can go down without even realizing that that was what triggered it.
It's Laurie Tyne Brody along with Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our physical therapy experts with you today. They're from Start Strong Physical Therapy online at startstrongpt.com and answering your questions at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us as Elaine did to talk@WPR.org. Should Elaine be trying this tug test, this timed up and go test to see if she can get under 10 seconds? Is that something that you would look at?
That would be certainly reasonable. It'd be even better if she had a partner or something that could start the timer and stop the timer so she's not trying to multitask and she tries to hit the timer really fast and misses a chair, things like that. So it'd be something that a partner or loved one could do with you. Absolutely.
Yeah, but also, you know, if you were to see a physical therapist, they would look at a number of different factors. So, you know, for her, it was situational. It was when she bent over and bent over quickly. So in that case, I would really want to look at her vestibular system, mm-hmm. like having changing head. I'm nodding for those who can't see it. So changing your head position to see if that elicits any instability. And sometimes we do single leg stance, or Jill talked about the DGI, the dynamic gait index. We have a whole bunch of different tools to assess balance, and you want to match the tool to the situation at hand. So the tug is one of the more common ones, but it doesn't address necessarily a specific case like Elaine had.
Right. For example, I work with athletes. If I pulled the tug test out in the athletic training room, I would be laughed at. So you do. Lori's point is so well taken. There's multiple ways that we can provoke or test somebody's balance, and it's really a hierarchical. And that's one of the jobs of the physical therapist is to determine the best test or battery of tests that are appropriate for the patient.
Well, gosh darn it, I got your website wrong, and I am so sorry. I want to make sure I got it right. It's strongstartpt.com. I got it back. It's not?
No, you had it right. It's startstrongpt.com.
Startstrongpt.com. Well, now they won't forget it, and neither will I. Are you sure? I'm here at strongstartpt.com. You want to double check?
That's somebody else's.
Oh, my goodness.
It's startstrongpt.com, and don't put the www in front of it. For whatever reason, I think it comes up faster if you don't.
Well, I'm glad we got that cleared up, and I'm sorry for the confusion. Startstrongpt.com to reach out. Because if we don't get to you today, there is a way that you can reach out to Lori and Jill and ask your questions, and they want to provide that forum for you. So startstrongpt.com. If we are unable to answer your questions today or have a follow-up, especially when it comes to falling. Let's go to Merritt in Wausau next. Hi, Merritt.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I recently just kind of developed plantar fasciitis, and I'm right in that age, that fun age group of 50 to 60. So just wondering if they had any suggestions. It looks like stretching is kind of the best medicine.
Okay, yep, so first of all, what is plantar fasciitis? What does that feel like for poor Merritt?
So I'm sure Merritt can tell you that the most classic symptom is excruciating pain in the bottom of your foot along the arch, your first step out of bed in the morning. And that's because all night long, your foot has been in a plantar flexed or a toes pointed position. So the plantar fascia is shortened. And then you get out of bed and you step down on it and you stretch it the other direction with all your weight, and it hurts like mad.
Oh,
yeah. So that's the classic. And yes, Merritt, that stretch with your toes up, it's not just a calf stretch, but it's a plantar fascia stretch where your toes are pointed up. I like doing this like at the bottom step to your staircase where your toes are pointed up. And then you flex your knee over the step. You get a really nice stretch to your soleus and your plantar fascia. Then the other thing is a night splint. 2 to 3 months in a night splint helps tremendously. You just have to be patient. And I have no shame. My favorite is the Darko. It goes on top of your foot instead of behind your foot. I have no financial interest in the Darko night splint myself, but Jill and I have both used it and really like it for plantar fasciitis.
Merritt, a couple of things you can do to try to ease the pain. And our guests today are your physical therapy experts, Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody. Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum is professor in the doctor program of physical therapy program at UW-Madison. Lori Tyne-Brody, professor at Rocky Mountain University of Health Professionals. They are both part of Start Strong Physical Therapy online at startstrongpt.com. I'm certain of it. And if you got confused today as I did, we'll put an actual accurate link up on our webpage as part of this show at wpr.org/Lee. Our conversation continues with your questions next at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us talk@wpr.org. It's Physical Therapy Today on the Lee Rayburn Show, and our guest, Lori Tyne-Brody, physical therapist and partner at Start Strong Physical Therapy, alongside her sister Jill, online at startstrongpt.com. She is also a professor of Rocky Mountain University of Health Professions. And Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum is a professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison, answering your questions today. And we're also talking about fall prevention, because it does appear to be an epidemic, even though it is a symptom and not a disease. You can join our conversation 1-800-642-1234 or email us talk@wpr.org. And before we get back to fall prevention, let's return to your calls, and we'll go to Kathleen in Madison. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Hi.
I'm calling because I have a condition that took years to figure out. And I wanted to put it out there because there may be other people with a similar issue. I have fallen all my life, and I've been tested in every imaginable way. And it all comes back saying you don't have bad balance. It's not a balance issue. The last test they gave me was on my eyes, and they discovered that my eyes do not track properly. So when I turn my head, there's a split second before my eyes catch up.
Ooh,
and that's long enough to fall over.
How did they find that out, Kathleen, finally, after all these years?
They put me in a black room with, I was totally immobilized. I couldn't move at all. And then they run lights, a little light, spot a light back and forth, up and down, often, and you're following with your eyes. And when they came out, they said, "Oh, that was really easy. You lost some track."
Jill, what do you think?
So there's multiple different tests. There's multiple different tests that you can do to look at eye tracking. Those are some things that are commonly done after a concussion. So we look at things called saccades and eye tracking, and we have people close their eyes, turn their head 30 degrees, and you should be able to look back where you started at the center point, things like that. So there's a myriad of eye testing that we do. But it's interesting, Kathleen, that many of those things do not get pulled out unless somebody has history of a concussion or something like that. So I have not seen them in anyone who doesn't have a history of some sort of mild traumatic brain injury. I haven't seen it in isolation.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
So have they treated that some way, and have the falls stopped?
They can't treat it. That was what they said. It's not treatable. I simply have to be aware of it. And I've had to train myself that when I'm turning, I pause. And that's just a split second. It's just to let my eyes catch up with what I'm doing.
Isn't that interesting? Because one of the things we said at the beginning was, before you stop and go, you should pause for a second.
Sure.
Yeah. And yeah, but yeah, that was a real surprise. And I'm 83 and I've been falling all my life.
Wow. I hope at least acknowledging this, recognizing it, can help prevent the next one, Kathleen. I appreciate you sharing your experience. There is another part of this, and it also goes back not just with Kathleen falling all her life, but Elaine and Madison, who emailed us earlier at 75 years old, this idea of post-fall syndrome, that there is a psychological component of taking a fall and being, you know, afraid of it happening again, and how that can change your own behavior.
Oh, absolutely. So people, it can change your behavior in a positive way, where, as you know, Kathleen said, she stops and pauses for a second before she takes that first step. She lets her eyes get caught up. But it can also have a negative psychosocial or psychological impact, where you decide you're not going to go out. You know, I'm not going to go any place that requires me to step up a curb. I'm not going to go someplace like a movie theater where the lighting is poor, or where there's going to be a crowd, or I'm going to be jostled. So your world can get very small if you are afraid that you're going to fall again.
And along those lines, if you see a physical therapist, they may recommend an assistive device. So prior to this, you were walking independently, and they may suggest a cane or a wheeled walker. And for many people, it's all about appearance and the perception of appearing vulnerable. Like I'm an easy target, perhaps, from a safety perspective. They don't like the looks of it. They don't want people to think that they're weak. And so there's a lot of other components that go with a post-fall recommendation of an assistive device, and the use of an assistive device can be a huge hurdle for many people to overcome.
I just appreciate that perspective. And I've got more questions, but I want to get back to yours at 1-800-642-1234. Kathleen, thank you for calling. We'll go to Jake and Madison next. Jake, hi.
Hello. So I have a couple vertebrae just below my ribs that seem to be locked up, and they don't really move. They're starting to pinch the nerves quite a bit now. And I'm having trouble finding somewhere at UW Health to get that released or manipulated, or I'm not sure where I can go.
So, Lori?
So what do you mean locked up? Was there a specific incident or injury, or what is it feeling like to you?
Yeah, I'm in construction. I've been in construction for a long time, so I think that's where my posture is bad. Mm-hmm. And they just don't seem to bend very well, and it pinches there when I bend.
Okay, so when you're moving, you feel a pinching sensation in a specific area of your back. Do I have that right?
Yes, and they're just not very mobile.
Okay. Well, there are several levels of your spine that aren't mobile in certain directions because of the way your facet joints are aligned. So different parts of your spine will move better in some planes. You have three planes: forward, back, side to side, and rotation. But if you're feeling sort of a pinching in a specific area, then you may have some areas that aren't moving as well as they should. So in the UW system, you should be able to see any of the physical therapists that work in outpatient orthopedics. That being said, I would look for somebody who is an orthopedic clinical specialist, an OCS, and there are several of those in the UW system. And if you call outpatient physical therapy, they should be able to connect you to somebody at one of their several clinics that has an OCS. Specifically, the Science Drive Center has a department that's really pretty dedicated to spine-related issues, and they should be able to help you as well. So those are all places I would start. But I would look for an OCS and someone who can do a little bit of manual therapy and then teach you some ways to keep those areas mobile yourself, whether it's using tennis balls or a foam roller or various things like that.
Jake, there's some resources, and thank you for the call. We'll go to Gary in Watertown next. Gary, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. The plantar fasciitis has been brought up on your program about, you know, getting out of bed in the morning, you know, when you have pain. That's not what I have. I have when I'm walking, I have a burning sensation on the bottom of my left heel most of the time. The left heel, yeah.
Okay. So there are a couple things that can be going on there. So you can get a nerve that's pinched there. Sometimes when you lose some of the cushioning in your heel, underneath your heel is a pretty thick fat pad that provides some cushion for the bottom of your foot. So there's a nerve that can get entrapped there. So that can be part of what's going on. You can also have a little bit of neuropathy there. And the question would be why you're getting it in one heel and not the other heel. So that's where a physical therapist may take a look at you and see if there's a leg length difference that might be contributing to that. And some people have tried a heel cup. You can buy a heel cup that, for lack of a better description, sort of smushes the fat pad from the outside to underneath your heel to provide a little more cushion. So you really have to kind of take a look at it and see why it is that you, Gary, are having this symptom in one heel. But there should be strategies to help you with that.
But that's not plantar fasciitis, right?
No, correct. No.
No, plantar fasciitis hurts not directly under the heel, but under
the arch.
Front of the heel toward the arch.
Yeah, yeah.
And plantar fasciitis typically feels better as you walk, and Gary's comes on as he walks. So those are different too.
Yeah, you got something else going on there, Gary, and it might take a physical therapist to help figure it out. Can your leg length change as you age?
Oh, boy, I don't know that I've ever had anybody ask me that question.
I mean, if it didn't happen to Gary when he was young, but now it's happening as he ages.
Well, it's okay. So, boy, I don't know how much time we have, Lee.
Sorry.
But sometimes you have a leg length difference that you've accommodated all your life. And then for some reason, you get to a certain age and your body can't keep up with that accommodation, or maybe you walk a little bit longer, you go to Disney for 3 days and you walk more, or you do something and you stir it up just a little bit, and then the leg length difference is enough to perpetuate the problem.
Okay.
So sometimes you have underlying things, not just a leg length difference, but a whole host of things, most classically being arthritis or some degenerative joint disease that's been there for a long time. Or if you go back to Matt and his rotator cuff, you know, his rotator cuff muscle was torn for a long time, but he did fine until there was an event. And then that event is enough to stir things up and perpetuate the problem.
I've just never thought about whether or not my legs are at different lengths. I just assumed they would be just fine. And now, Jill, it's got me thinking about
everybody has a leg length discrepancy. Everyone has a leg length discrepancies. Nobody's legs are perfect. And it's just a matter of how far you're off and if you can accommodate.
Right, how vain of me to think my legs were perfect all this time.
Yeah, shame on you, Lee.
Yeah.
Sorry to burst your bubble.
Yeah.
Sorry to burst your bubble on our first show.
Gary, I've learned a lot from your call. Thank you very much. And I hope you find what you're looking for in getting some help. We'll go to Brian and Bailey's Harbor next. Brian, hello.
I had hernia repair surgery for an inguinal hernia in March, so a little over 4 months ago. About 6 weeks ago, after everything was going well, I started having pain in my lower groin. And it's intermittent. Some days are better than others. And Cleveland Clinic website says there may be a physical therapy solution to this. Just wondering what you think.
So an inguinal hernia repair, sometimes called athletic pubalgia, things like that. It's a little bit of a tug of war between two muscles that attach there, your big abdominal musculature and also your hip adductors, the muscles that you use as if you're going to squeeze a ball between your knees. So one of the underlying issues that we see with a lot of people who have this is they do not know how to recruit the right core muscles to stabilize their spine, and they overuse other muscles. And so, Brian, if you haven't seen a physical therapist, I would suggest seeing one just to make sure that your motor recruitment of these muscles there is appropriate, so you're not over recruiting or using an adductor muscle, for example, as a substitute for some other muscles to help stabilize your spine, hence getting that groin pain. So there's a little bit of neuromuscular reeducation and kind of retraining the muscles in this area that need to happen after you have that procedure done. So if you haven't seen a physical therapist, I strongly encourage you to see one. Have you seen somebody, Brian?
I have not. This is my first inquiry. So thank you so much for the education.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yes. It probably won't take very many visits, but it'll train you to use the right muscles down there so you won't kind of end up in this situation again.
Brian, thank you for calling. We'll go to Carol in Verona next. Hi, Carol.
Good morning. I was calling because I had had a fall off a horse. Well, I got bucked off and injured my shoulder, ended up with biceps tendinopathy, and there was another tear in there. And then last October, I got a tear. I did something again, only to the spinatus, one of those muscles. The orthopedist injected my biceps tendinopathy in October, and that lasted 3 months, and then it was gone. And I was having a lot of pain, waking up at night, not sleeping, and so on and so forth. So I didn't want to have another shot. But because I'm a horse person and we use shockwave therapy a lot in horses, I thought I'd see if I could find somebody. And I started that in May with a lot of improvement. So really, I'm just interested in your general opinion of this. It does not seem to be easily available except through a physical therapist or a chiropractor in this area. Just wondering what you think.
Shockwave therapy, Jill.
Yes, it's a extracorporeal shockwave therapy, and the most data and research we have behind it is in two locations. Number one, for plantar fasciitis, and then speak of the devil, and number two, for lateral epicondylia, or kind of a chronic elbow tendinopathy of those tendons at the elbow. So to extrapolate the successful research that we've had behind using it at the elbow to Carol's biceps tendon makes sense. So it causes a deep, deep, deep form of vibration that is somewhat uncomfortable. Carol can probably attest to that. But in theory, what we think it does is it creates almost an inflammatory, kind of almost kicks off the inflammatory cycle. So you get blood flow coming in there, kind of flushing out all the bad stuff. Then you help remodel the tendon with some good stretching and mobilization, things like that. So anecdotally, we use it in my environment all the time. So I don't know how many physical therapy clinics in the Madison area have them, but it is accessible in Madison. I know there are a few out there that have them.
And a viable treatment.
So what I will tell you is we don't have that much robust evidence behind it, other than plantar fasciitis and, like I said, the lateral elbow tendinopathy. And so to kind of take that information and go to a different tendon, because I'm guessing what Carol's physical therapist did, and she's having a good outcome with it.
Carol, thank you for the call. Our physical therapy experts, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum from Start Strong Physical Therapy, online at startstrongpt.com. And before we get back to your questions and emails, I want to follow up on the conversation we're having about preventing falls today, because we really haven't talked about the best ways to prevent them in terms of physical therapy and what sort of basic exercises we can do to make sure that we have the balance that we need and we can overcome any sort of external factors that might cause falls. Lori?
Yeah. So, you know, it fundamentally boils down to doing a good examination and figuring out the cause of falls if you are a faller. So is it vision? Is it vestibular? Is it situational? Is it strength? And that's where we would really focus our intervention. For somebody who wants a falls prevention program, we really work on things like strengthening. And it's not just strengthening, like strengthening your core. Strengthening your core is just huge for so many things. But one of the issues we often see with people is we can assess their strength, but they don't use it
in the situation. So that's where the neuromuscular training piece comes in. And Jill talked about that relative to the inguinal hernia that Brian had, and that you can be strong and we can test you, but if you're not using the right muscles at the right time, you can still be at risk for a fall or injury. So working on those things, and then simply working on balance strategies, you know, single leg stance, turning head, moving arms. We just layer different things on and generally set people up on a program that they can continue at home if they have a safe place to do that. We'll often have people do it, for example, in a doorway. Mm-hmm. And then we love getting people into a community program like a Tai Chi program. It's a lot of evidence on the benefits of Tai Chi and balance in the elderly. So that's another place people can go if they just want to work on maintaining or improving their balance in a community situation.
Yeah, there's another one in town called Ballroom Basics for Balance 4B. Mm-hmm. And so it, you know, all those multi-planar movements. So I think the thing that's important to consider is if you're in that situation where you're going to have a loss of balance, it'd be nice if you've been there before and your body knows how to respond. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the intent of a lot of the therapy is to, you know, as Lori said, do those things in a safe space, in a pool, in between a door jamb where you're not at risk of falling, but teach your muscles the proprioceptive input, how to respond should you be in that situation.
And I that is such an important point, and I'm so glad you brought it up, because that's often what I tell my patients. It's that it's not that when we do these balance exercises that you're going to be a lot better at balance at this balance exercise in 3 or 4 weeks, but that when you get in a situation where you lose your balance, your brain goes, oh, I know what to do. And you don't have to think about it because you don't have time to think about it right when you fall, just as, you know, the Elaine, when she fell over, you know, you don't have time to react. So you need your body to plug in that motor program right away to restore your balance without having to stop and think about it. And that's what the training does.
It's muscle memory.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
We've got time for one more quick call. We'll go to Scott in Oconomowoc next. Scott, hi.
Hi. First time caller. I love your show.
Thank you.
My question is, I had was in a car accident 36-3 some years ago, and I lost my right leg below the knee. I have had phantom lame ever since, and I really went through the College of Wisconsin, through their pain clinics, and, you know, nothing has seemed to work. I even had radiocarpentry, where they would put a probe in my leg and burn out the nerve bundles.
Man.
And it really is very, very discomforting. At bed at night, I can't sleep because sometimes if I walk around a lot of day, it just keeps on firing. The only relief I get from that is using marijuana. And I'm sorry you have to say
no,
that.
No, I appreciate your honesty, Scott. And let's see, I had never thought of this, phantom limb syndrome, and whether or not there is some sort of physical therapy that could alleviate it, Jill.
So phantom limb pain is not uncommon at all in patients who experience an amputation, especially a traumatic amputation, is my understanding. And boy, to still have phantom limb pain after 30 years is really high. I don't feel like I've heard anybody who's had it this significantly this long post-amputation. So everything that Scott is talking about, the burning of the nerves and things like that, is a common strategy. Lori may suggest the pool.
Yeah, well, the pool would be fine to get some regular exercise. So part of this is people have pain, and so they are just no longer feel like they can be active.
Right.
So sometimes just getting into a regular activity program can help. I don't know how long it's been since Scott has been to the pain clinic or been to a physical therapist. But, you know, in the past 10 years or so, there's been a lot of advances.
Agreed.
In the pain neuroscience space and how we treat patients and work with patients who have this chronic long-standing pain, because we know there are changes in their brain after having pain for this many years. So there's a lot of new strategies that physical therapists, particularly physical therapists, and they usually work in a team that works using pain neuroscience education to help people like Scott.
Scott, I hope you find some relief, and I thank you for the call. Lori and Jill, I thank you so much for returning and joining us and helping our listeners month in and month out, and I always learn something, like my unperfect legs today. Thank you both.
We learn a lot from our callers as well, so we appreciate them calling in with their questions. It always helps us grow as well.
Well, we'll talk to you again. Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist and partner at Start Strong Physical Therapy, alongside her sister, Jill. Lori is also a professor at Rocky Mountain University of Health Professions. Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. If we were unable to get to your call today, you can find them online at startstrongpt.com. That's startstrongpt.com. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you are listening to WPR News.